Is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon, and it's a business talk and all of that, and maybe a little Jared Kushner as well, right? We're expecting him to make probably a brief statement, Kim Gordon, right, once he talks?
Yeah, I would think so. They've already got the mics and everything set up right outside the White House, so we're expecting it about 12:15. We'll keep you posted.
All right, we'll see that, and we'll carry that when it happens. But before that, we say hello to Karis Husted, who is, well, she's my favorite Chicago Inno boy.
Aw, thanks. Not a boy, but a person, yes.
when Karis would first start coming in, I was always used to saying the Inno boys, and then I would say the Inno boy, and then I'd get to look across the console from you. But you're flying solo today. Where are the boys?
Yeah, they are both on vacation, so we finally have the chance to trash talk both of them. I've been waiting for this day.
And that's how I started. And I'm going to say goodbye to you. Tell me, you're off on an adventure.
Yep, I'm heading to grad school in the fall. I'm going to be studying journalism in Europe.
So for a couple of years in Denmark, you said?
Yep, Denmark and London. So doing some more international focus, but then also a business and finance track in London. So
that's exciting.
Interesting.
And so what do you do? Do you think you see yourself working out of London for a long time to come, or just for the two-year adventure?
We'll have to see. I mean, pretty much everything is up in flux, I feel like, within this world. So I'm just going to go to school and kind of see what happens.
Karis Husted here from Chicago Inno. Oh, Pokemon Go, it went. What happened?
Yeah, so the first Pokemon Go Fest ever happened in Grand Park this weekend.
And we were talking about it for so long,
yeah.
And they were secretive about just how many tickets they were selling and all of this stuff.
Well, it sold out in minutes. I mean, literally within like 5 minutes, all the tickets were gone. They were only $20. They expected 20,000 attendees from around the world. And this was going to be kind of the first in-person meetup for Pokemon Go, which is a big deal because it's an augmented reality app. So most people are just playing it on their own, playing it in different cities. But it did not go according to plan. Basically, people showed up on Saturday, and by 8 a.m., there were thousands of people in line. So already there were, like, crazy festival lines. After that, most players couldn't even log into the game. There was limited cell receptions and really crammed up servers. And then once the CEO took the stage, he was basically met with boos and people saying, we can't right. play the game.
I mean, this is a monumental fail, really, isn't it? Because it was a one-off, first time they've ever done anything like this. People traveling from all over, and I know they're offering refunds, but people bought it on the secondary market for hundreds of dollars. And how do you, well, I don't know, will this company suffer for that? Or the people going to play Pokemon Go are still going to play, they just might not go to one of these festivals again?
Yeah, I think that's the big thing, is that this was sort of an experiment by Niantic, which is the company who created Pokemon Go, to figure out how do you make this sustainable. You know, apps are really hard. How do you keep it from being a one-hit wonder to something that you can actually make to be a sustainable business model? And events are a big part of that.
Well, they figured out how not to do it,
exactly.
So maybe next time they'll try. You know, it's got to succeed next time, right?
Well, I mean, all you really have to do is make sure people can play the game. To me, I feel like that's the most important thing, and they did not succeed on that front, so that will be definitely priority number one.
That's Karis Husted. She writes for Chicago Inno. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Airbnb has tried to add, you know, it's all about experiential travel, right? So they've done that in other cities, and now they're adding some experiences to Chicago. Karis Husted is in the studio. She writes, for the time being, for Chicago Inno, before she's off on her higher education adventures to Europe. You know, just one more question about that then. So it seems like studying in Europe at this time is an especially interesting one. You cover tech. They cover, I don't know if we're in a tech race, but we certainly on a couple of different tracks. It'll be interesting for you to observe over there what's happening there compared to here.
Yeah. Definitely want to explore, just because I think in the U.S. you're seeing a bit of a shift in terms of policy and, you know, who we're letting in terms of innovators. But in Europe, there's a lot more regulation, which has kind of stymied a bit of innovation. So I'm interested to get there and kind of see what the energy feels like these
days.
That
struck me, too. Jamie Dimon talked last week about how he's embarrassed sometimes to say, right, he's American because of all the regulation getting in the way of business. And I'm thinking, wait, everyone complains in Europe about the regulation there. So I'm not quite sure I understand where those two fit together.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to find out.
All right, Karis Husted is here. And before that, though, she wrote about Airbnb and what they're doing to try to sort of add experiences to travel, right? Now, this is not new to Airbnb, but it's new to Chicago.
Right. So Airbnb, as we know, is basically a leader in authentic travel. You get to stay with people who are locals where you're living, which kind of gives a different experience. You get a little bit more of that authentic travel experience. But now they're taking it one step further with the launch of this trip service. So these are experiences that are local-led. So it's somebody taking you around their neighborhood, giving you a tour of historic sites in Bronzeville, or an afternoon playing beach volleyball in North Avenue Beach. So kind of taking the local experience one step further.
I know I read somewhere not too long ago where Icelandair their flight attendants would do this with passengers in Reykjavik. You know, they'd land and then they'd take them around the city and things like that. So this is sort of a way to do that. Why are they doing this? Because it seems like they're not, I don't think they're facing a lot of competition in this sort of market, right? Why would they be doing this?
Well, I think, again, Airbnb wants to be the leader in authentic travel. And, you know, they've cornered the home sharing market. I mean, they're already doing quite well there. And so now they're trying to think of how do we get more people on our platform, both in terms of travelers and hosts, because people can actually apply to be a host of an experience.
Oh, that's what I like. So tell me, you know, and I've been racking my brain trying to think of something I could host.
Yeah, me
but
too.
I think it's a pretty interesting thing. So tell me, if people come to Chicago, what sorts of Airbnb trips they might be able to choose from.
Right. So in addition to the like walking tour of historic sites in Bronzeville and the afternoon playing beach volleyball, there's an intro to podcasting production with local podcast hosts. There's a 2.5 hour lakeside workout and stretching class. And then there's a tour of Wicker Park speakeasies. And there's about 20 that they launched so far here in Chicago. And these range from about $20 to $90. So it's kind of up to you on what you want to go to in terms of your price, and then they're kind of all around the city. So it gets people into areas that they might not have gone to otherwise.
And are they're up and running now, do you know?
Yes, they have launched it and they're up and running.
How popular have they been so far?
This was within the last week, so okay. Right now we just know that they've launched, and I'm sure that they'll find out within the next few months which ones work.
So seriously, this is an opportunity for a small business or an individual in the city to come up with some sort of idea, pitch it to Airbnb, right? And then Airbnb puts it up.
Yep, exactly. You basically host an experience instead of a home.
I love it. All right. So we'll see how that goes. And well, I'll be offering, how about a behind the scenes look at a business lunch show every day?
Okay. Yeah. What do you want to charge for it?
$350,000 a person.
Okay. There you go.
We'll see how it goes. tell me about, there's another piece in Chicago Inno that is interesting to me. The statistic here, let me see. Roughly 1 in 13 kids, 2 in every classroom, deals with some sort of food allergy. We think of peanut butter or whether it's a milk allergy or things like that. And so what you try to do is you can't bring peanuts to school. You can't do this. You can't do that. But there's a group or a study out of University of Chicago trying to treat it a different way. Explain that for me.
Yeah, exactly. So what you're kind of talking about here is mostly how we react to, we deal with food allergies is we react to them. So you get an EpiPen or you try to prevent some sort of connection to the allergens. You tell kids not to bring peanut products into schools, but all of this is very reaction-based, which, you know, it can be very stressful for a parent if
sure,
your kid has
right.
a very intense
allergy. I mean, every day you don't know if something's going to happen.
Exactly. So this University of Chicago startup called ClostraBio is basically trying to target the symptoms and the sort of underlying cause of allergic reactions rather than the reaction. So they figured out that certain children who have certain types of allergies have a lower level of bacteria in their gut than other people do. And so what they're focused on is making that lining and the mucus in the digestive tract a little bit thicker to prevent the allergen from getting to the immune system where it triggers that allergic reaction.
So they're not going to stop the child from being allergic. They're going to fix the results of that allergic reaction.
Yeah, right. So basically, when you have an allergic reaction, it means that the allergen has hit your immune system and has like an intense reaction to it, and then you break out in hives or your throat closes up and you have this really intense reaction. This is basically preventing that allergen from hitting that immune system in the first place.
And I know that they're doing well, right? But they're looking for some funding to sort of expand it, or where are they that way?
Yeah, so they're pretty early stage, as most, you know, medical-related startups are. They've done trials in mice, and, you know, coming up in the future, they like to do human trials. But they definitely have some traction. They recently won a $200,000 investment from the University of Chicago Innovation Fund, plus $40,000 from UChicago's New Venture Challenge.
But Karis, why hasn't someone tried or thought of this before, or have they?
So I think the big thing with this coming out of UChicago is they just launched a microbiome center. So they're really doubling down on research and startups around the microbiome in the gut, which is sort of this science believes that this has to do with a lot of the issues that we have in our body, but it just hasn't been studied to the extent that we need it to actually create the therapy. So UChicago is basically doubling down on the
gut. All right, one more. Let's go to a booth at University of Chicago where they've come up with this sort of coding. I will call it just a broad survey class, right? That sort of fits a real need. Explain that for me.
Yeah. So basically, this class called Application Development is teaching MBAs how to code so that they can better manage technical teams as well as launch their own startup. So basically, an MBA could take a Computer Science 101 class, but it's just not set up for MBAs.
Right, it's
like really dense, very tech heavy. And then what are you going to do with that knowledge?
And so you end up losing those people because they take the specified class for the computer geeks, if you will, and then they miss out.
It doesn't really apply to what they're trying to learn. And so this class takes elements of code boot camps, which are that kind of new condensed version of learning computer science in a very applicable way. And it brings it to an MBA student so they know how to manage their technical teams.
That's Karis Husted, writes for Chicago Inno. It was wonderful talking just the two of us today.
Yes.
I'm sorry it's the last time, but I'm excited for your adventure. Have a great time. Learn a lot. And check in from time to time as well from Europe, will you?
All right. Sounds good. I'll be on the business lunch, foreign correspondent.
As soon as you can say it in Danish, you can be on.
Okay.
Or just
bring
it Danish. Whatever. It's your choice.
Okay.
You know, people who design restaurants, restaurant designers or creators are now building dining rooms with Instagram in mind. So they're coming up with the design, the decor of their restaurant by how it will look on social media. That's one of the things we'll talk to Randy Schaefer about a little bit later. She's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune. But before that, U.S. consumers spent about $2.1 trillion in cash transactions last year. That's expected to drop to $1.9 trillion in 2021. How do I know that? Well, I read everything Marie Lamagna writes in MarketWatch, and she joins us on a phone line now. Maria, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You bet. And so I'm interested in this story. You talk about Visa and what they're trying to do in sort of, I don't know if it's limiting or eliminating cash transactions, but it seems to me that we are headed in this direction. It will happen one day or another. What's up with Visa and what's their incentive program here?
Yes, so they announced earlier this month that they are offering up to $50,000 to different restaurants and food vendors that agree to go completely cashless. And, you know, obviously there's some incentive for Visa to do that. They're hoping people will spend money on their Visa cards. But, yeah, they basically are trying to give these restaurants and food vendors a reason to no longer accept cash and kind of stir up some good PR for all the cashless options in the meantime.
So what does that mean? I mean, $50,000, that must be almost a restaurant chain or something like that, right? They would give up cash transactions and then get that money from Visa?
Right. And I think they are kind of targeting smaller food vendors.
Okay.
They basically want to give them the money to set up what they would need to go cashless. So, you know, maybe it's a new register, or, you know, sometimes for things like a farmer's market type vendor, they need the actual equipment to do it. And so I think they're kind of looking to just get people set up to start becoming cashless.
I mean, how about it? Do you think this is where we're going to end up one day?
I think it's actually happening a lot slower than you might expect.
Really?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously I'm writing about this a lot, and there's a lot of other reporters writing about these cashless initiatives. And, you know, we definitely are seeing a decrease in cash. But if you think about worldwide, you know, there are still a lot of people that do rely on cash for a variety of reasons. You know, we also see generational changes. Yes, younger people are more willing to use debit cards and also credit cards. But there are, you know, a surprising amount of people that still want to use checks, still want to use cash. And so it's, you know, a lot of the experts that I'm speaking to, even the ones that work on the payments companies, are willing to admit, yes, we're moving in that direction, but we are not there yet. And it's probably going to take quite a while.
That's interesting. I keep referring in my head to an article I read a year or two ago because I thought it would be an interesting topic and I never quite got to it. I think it was Sweden or Finland or somewhere where they actually planned to go cashless. Does that sound familiar to you at all?
Yes, that is true. China is also rapidly becoming cashless. So we are seeing other countries set sort of these precedents for going cashless faster than we are. You know, I think the U.S. is unique in that there are so many different people and so many different, you know, walks of life, so many differences between cities and towns and between states. And, you know, it's kind of hard to get consumer behavior all on one page, whereas some of those smaller Nordic countries, they can kind of more easily get everyone to do the same thing. And, you know, obviously there's a lot to be said for American individualism and people not wanting the government
right.
to tell them what to do. So I think some of those international differences are definitely, you know, you're seeing some countries get there faster.
Well,
than
I'll
others.
Tell you a way to speed it up. Just tell people that if you study their dollar bills, you'll find traces of cocaine or feces or acne or dog spit on them, right? That was part of your article.
Yes. That's actually true. I was surprised to find that out. But, you know, because of the materials that cash is made out of, they actually do hold on to a lot of disgusting things. So if you are concerned about that, you know, using your smartphone or a piece of plastic like a credit card or debit card is actually a little less germy. Probably not. There's probably not enough of those gross things on cash to actually make you sick, but it is kind of disgusting.
Well, let's just start the campaign because I want to go cashless as soon as possible. So I was interested, too, that I hadn't thought of it. We talk about paper money, but these bills are made, as you said, of materials, cotton and linen, that might hold on to these things more often. There's a restaurant, is it Tobacco Road in Kentucky, that's got some rules about cash?
Yeah, so I actually wrote about that. It was last year. They were apparently it's a small store in Kentucky, and they were having a lot of problems with like people going running and then pulling sweaty cash out. You know, people like kind of just doing gross things and handing over their cash to the cashiers, and they were saying, you know, we're no longer going to accept sweaty money. So I totally get that. I think for vendors that is pretty disgusting. If people are handing you like wadded up bills that are they just pulled out of a gross place, like you might be incentivized to go cashless at that point.
Is there a cost involved? I mean, you know, right away you think, well, yeah, if you use your credit card, the merchants are having to pay 1% to 3% more. So that probably would lead to an increased cost for all of us. But I was interested to read in your story that just using paper money and maintaining paper money comes with its costs as well.
Yes, it's more expensive than people probably realize. I didn't think about all the things, you know, it's things like getting the big trucks to bring cash to ATMs, you know, reprinting money that gets destroyed. There are a lot of costs, actually, to keeping cash in circulation, you know, not to mention that a lot of governments don't like the fact that people want to do under-the-table transactions. They don't want to be taxed, so that's another reason why a lot of people like paying in cash. So there are a lot of costs to governments, which is a big reason, as you mentioned earlier, certain countries are making it mandatory.
So if we go back to 2005, there were 5.6 billion, right? Billion bills in circulation. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we do have a lot of bills.
Maria, let me tell you, I've read that three times and it didn't sound so crazy until I said it out loud. That's a lot of bills. And that was in 2005. 25.6 billion in 2005. And today there are almost 40 billion, 39.8 billion pieces of cotton and linen that we're carrying around to buy things with.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, obviously that includes a lot of ones, but that is the case. And, you know, we are having to print more. You know, our actual population is growing, which is one reason why there's more people walking around carrying cash. But, yes, that's true. The number of banknotes in circulation is actually up. And people, another fact that surprised me is that people are also going to ATMs in the same numbers
just
that they were
often.
A few years ago.
Yeah, that does surprise me.
Yeah, so, and they pull out a little bit more than before, actually, but they're still going, you know,
okay, so
going in just as often.
Let's wrap it up then. Is this an evil plan on Visa's part that they're just trying to get more transaction fees? Or is this sort of a natural development in where we will end up being one day, even if it's getting there more slowly than I thought we might be?
Right. Some people, I mean, it was interesting to hear you say, you know, I'm kind of rooting for it because some people are strongly against it. And every time I write about this, you know, a lot of people will contact me and say, this is just a government ploy. You know, we don't want all of our transactions to be tracked. This feels very Big Brother and very disgusting. We don't want this to be happening. So a lot of people feel strongly that they don't want it. You know, for the payment companies, that's obvious. They're trying to make a profit. Like, you know, we can't dress that up. That's what they're trying to do.
Right.
But, you know, we'll see what happens. I think there are a lot of benefits. We saw, you know, we've seen a company like Uber become a company basically because they made paying for something easier.
Right,
you know, there's clearly a consumer demand for making payments easy. So I think the more we see things like that, the more it probably will happen.
Using paper money for me is always my second choice. It's never my first choice.
Maria, me too, I have to say.
Read more, Maria Lamagna at MarketWatch.com. Great to talk to you again. I can't wait for the next time.
Thanks, you too.
Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She's a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune and climbs down the stairs once a week every Monday to come join us on the Business Lunch. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me.
Where do you want to start? So I want to tweet after I'm dead. Can I do that?
You absolutely can.
Okay, why would I want to tweet after I'm dead?
That's a very good question. I can't answer that question, but I can answer the how.
Okay, explain this for me because it's a pretty... Well, I mean, there's the physical sciencesness of it, but there's the sort of social idea of it, too, which is remarkable to me.
Right. Right. It's very, very strange. So the New York Post wrote this story about how you can email from beyond the grave. Basically, what you do is you pre-draft all these emails, and then every month you log in with a password. If you stop entering that password, the site assumes you're dead, and it starts kicking out these emails.
What a terrible idea.
Don't write anything bad about your boss, just in case.
Right. So I'm assuming you're going to write these sort of, you know, go to hell emails.
I was thinking sentimental, but I guess we're on a different wavelength there.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, we just must have a different email list.
And so if you don't have an email list, you can even kind of take it to Twitter. This website, Dead Social, will allow you to post after you're dead. And so you can schedule Facebook posts, you know, for your death anniversary or for the wedding of your firstborn child, or who knows really why you want to post after you're dead. I'm not dead. I haven't really put that much thought into it. But
well, I'm thinking there was a Michael Keaton movie. And I think it's sort of a movie mechanism where people who are gravely ill, they record these messages, right? And you play it on your birthday or things like that. And that's kind of what this would be. So
yeah.
Every year on your birthday, you'd get a message from mom, even though she's been dead for 15 years?
It seems a little more romantic when it's in letter form and not when it's posted on your computer monitor, I think.
Yeah, if you're opening one. So if it's a card and you're sitting them aside.
Yeah, I know. I have some friends that have, you know, have parents, grandparents that have passed, and they've written out cards to be opened on birthdays. But just the thought of having somebody dead pop up in your Facebook feed seems a little unnerving to me.
I think that maybe that is a difference. So do they get a card every year?
I have a friend who got one on her 21st birthday.
Okay, yeah,
so
I get that.
Something like that.
Yeah, you're right, and that is different, I guess. Okay, here's the weirder, the social part of it. So then they'll use algorithms or their mechanisms where they can figure out what you would likely tweet, right?
Yeah.
Or what you would likely retweet, and then that can live on in perpetuity.
Isn't that crazy? These algorithms can look at your sense of humor, your frequency of post, and they can kind of robotically draft these posts that you might tweet so you can actually troll beyond the grave.
So they can duplicate your Twitter practices so that you continue to do it, so that your followers continue to see your tweets even after you're dead.
Yeah, so your followers might not even need to know that you're dead. Isn't that insane?
Well, I'm just wondering about it. So it's kind of weird on so many levels. One is, why would you want that to happen? And two is, look where we are now that we, you know, with artificial intelligence, really, we're going to know less and less about what's real and what's not. Well, who's real and who's not?
It is very crazy.
Yeah. And so, this is a potential, or is this up and running?
I know that these websites do actually exist. I think the algorithms are still kind of being tweaked. I'm a little afraid to see what they look like now. I don't think we're advanced enough for that. But these websites are real.
All right. So we'll see that. And who knows? Maybe before long, you will be able to keep tweeting.
I
want to do that.
Yeah.
I think after I pass, I'll pass.
Yeah.
Let's just live that way. All right. Tell me about Instagram and the influence it. This is a remarkable story. The influence it now has on restaurant design.
So more and more these days, restaurateurs, when they're opening up a new space, they're saying, how can I make my restaurant Instagrammable? And so gone are, you know, moody cocktail bars with the dim, sexy lighting. Everything has to be bright, white, open. There need to be murals, pretty floor tiles.
So if you go into a restaurant and it's dark, you're not going to get a good picture.
Yeah,
so
your martini's going to be underexposed.
So it doesn't lend itself to Instagram, and so that's bad for business.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, your bar can be really pretty, but Instagram itself is such a powerful marketing tool that it's kind of crazy for businesses to not take advantage of it.
Are there businesses that are specifically designed, not defensively, but offensively, I guess that's not the right, proactively? Like, look, we're going to have an Instagram motif inside.
Yeah, so this Verge story that I have in front of me actually is talking about the San Francisco restaurant called Medianoche, and they designed entirely for the Instagram aesthetic. And I know that there's a few restaurants in Chicago actually that you walk in and you're like, oh wow, this is going to look great on my Instagram. So it's pretty prevalent across the country.
And so Medianoche does this, and then they get the people come in, they share the pictures. Have they seen results? Have they seen people coming from overseas or wherever?
They have, yeah. A lot of people that come in, they can't directly measure it, but a lot of people that come in will say, oh, I have to put this on my Instagram, or oh, I've seen this on Instagram. And so there's definitely a big connection there.
And I think I just found the quote I was looking for. The guy from Medianoche says, the average guest takes pictures for 10 minutes before ordering anything.
Your food's going to get cold.
Well, you haven't ordered yet, so you'll be fine that way. But so you sit in, you take pictures. That's a pretty It's a pretty remarkable spot we're in.
It is, yeah.
Okay, so there's that. Oh, and there's the other one with the shark bite drink.
Yeah, yeah. And the funny thing about that is the inventors of this cocktail, they didn't even intend for it to be Instagram popular. It just kind of became Instagram popular, and they went with it.
All right, so decide on your next restaurant design by... Well, that's good, because I can never read the menu in those dark places anyway. So now people with bad eyes like me will benefit.
And you can see what you're eating, too.
How about that?
I see no downside.
It's a win-win. I'm going to live forever. Randy Schaefer, digital editor from Chicago Tribune. Nice to see you again. We'll see you next week.